End of the week, mailbag edition of the pod. Thanks again to everyone who contributed on that Reddit thread. Some more great questions. We've really been enjoying doing these. It's just such a fun way to get into the NBA, tackle some historical stuff. Lots of really interesting questions coming up here. Our sponsors today, ZipRecruiter. Good to have them back on the show. Right now, my listeners can post jobs for free on ZipRecruiter by going to ZipRecruiter.com/capspace. Let's get started, Daniel. Where do we want to go first?
So question is from JPOW771. Draymond seemed upset with the new CBA. Any ideas on specifically what this could be?
I'm going with J-Pow, like kind of like J-Wow from Jersey Shore. That was really the last
time I was giving them deference by not going with that.
That was basically the last time I watched TV. It was like 2009. Well, I actually owe Draymond an apology, and maybe BJ Armstrong too, because I tweeted last night that I thought it was probably about some of the issues that they've been having and Draymond not getting maybe as much as he wanted in restricted free agency. But he was asked about it today at practice, and he said basically that his issue was that they're not doing enough to take care of some of the minimum guys in the league to distribute the income a little bit more. It's not about his own situation. He says he's an all-star. I'm doing fine. And this is interesting because I've kind of made the same argument at times that if you really want to just create the most happiness among the players, more of a distribution helps, right? Is it, do you create more happiness by one player making $20 million and another person making the minimum? Or do you create more happiness by two players making $10 million? On the other hand, though, it's not fair necessarily to the Steph Currys and LeBron Jameses and even maybe the Draymond Greens of the world, where those guys, in terms of the amount that they add to wins, they're probably worth $50 million, $60 million a year instead of what they are going to be getting.
I understand his sentiment, and it's a very nice thing, but also a point that he made in his comments, which I think was fair, is that it's more about the mentality than like those players are underpaid, because he talked about how they all make good money, and I believe it's that they're good, the minimums are going up 45%, so that's going to be even more true at that point. So the NBA will always have trouble finding an equilibrium. It's the nature of also being a soft cap sport, is that you're going to have some weird situations where teams are, because he talked about this, the idea of like maxes and minimum guys, and realistically that's also what the mid-level exception is supposed to be. And part of the reason that the league was a little bit out of whack the last few years was because the difference between the minimum and the room mid-level exception, like let's say for Zaza Pachulia, and then the full mid-level exceptions wasn't big enough, so players just took the minimum instead. And now when they're raising those and scale them to the cap, maybe it will create a little bit more of a middle class just by making it palatable.
Yeah, and Draymond had some nice sentiments about, hey, you know, the 15th man is important, you need a sub, you get injured, like you need those guys, like, and well, I think that's a great sentiment as part of a team. That frankly is probably not true. The replaceability of someone at the end of the roster is such that, you know, the difference between the 400th and the 600th best player in the world is not really that great. You know, it's really about the top end talent that you have on your team, and really about probably, you know, your top nine guys too. I mean, because even, you know, if you have a terrible bench, that's really going to hurt you, and you know, injuries can happen and stuff, but it's just those guys are much more replaceable. And I happen to agree with Draymond too. I think the current system, to me, probably does a better job of that than just a totally open system would with the max salaries. I kind of like the way that things are right now. Frankly, I think maybe raising the minimums a little bit so that just, you know, if you play a couple of years in the league, you're in a position, if you manage your money properly, to really be set. You know, if you play 2 years now, you've probably made, you know, your take home pay with taxes is probably like $600,000. You're not there. So I think maybe that's something that could be done. Taking care of second rounders a little bit more, letting them get guaranteed money. Like I think that we've talked about how the required tender system there, I think, needs an upgrade. So there are some things at the margin, but I think overall, the system is pretty decent to me as it is.
I like your point about second round picks. That's a good area that could get some real improvement.
I will be back with more questions, but first this from ZipRecruiter. Back when I was a lawyer, hiring was a really difficult process. I was involved in it to some degree, and you didn't really know where you wanted to post your job. You could post it on social media. You could go even on Craigslist. Sometimes the firm would post jobs there on industry specific sites. You really on LinkedIn. There's a lot of places you could post it, but the more places you posted it, the more annoying it was. It was really difficult to have to manage all those and all those inquiries, and then you have to log into each one and get back to the candidates. ZipRecruiter now has ended that annoying morass. Yes. They already have 9 million resumes you can search through in their database. They post your job at all the top job sites. So you can just log into ZipRecruiter. That's all you have to do. You don't have to deal with all these other passwords, all these other interfaces. You can just post it to social media, 100 plus job sites, all with a single click. You can quickly screen candidates, rate them, hire the right person fast and easily. And if you have any issues, ZipRecruiter is friendly and human. Support staff is ready to help. Find out today why they've been used by over 1 million businesses. To get started by them, my listeners can go post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/capspace. That's the URL, ZipRecruiter.com/capspace. Easy to remember because we talk about capspace all the time in this program. One more time, to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/capspace. Nate and Seth did a pod in the spring discussing their best offensive five-man unit, and JR Trigger, the user who asked this, was kind enough to repost who we had. My list was Curry, MJ, LeBron, KD, and Duncan, and this is for playing under the current rules. And Seth actually was Curry, MJ, Magic at the three, LeBron, and Dwight Howard, a pick that I was actually somewhat jealous of getting Dwight in there, because he would be a little bit better, I think, than Duncan offensively with that group. And this was, you know, last year's Curry, who just was completely unstoppable. So I guess there's two ways to look at that. Number one is if you're trying to construct a unit to play defense now, and another one would be, you know, if you wanted a more versatile group to deal with kind of some of the larger centers that you had to deal with at earlier times in NBA history.
Agree with the logic. And the challenge for me was dealing with the kind of the differences in position. So if we're going modern, I'd want to go very switch heavy. So you want bigs that can defend smalls, and you want smallish guys that can defend bigs. And my answer to that was to go big, because if you only have to choose five guys, you can make it work with players like LeBron James, who are big but could defend. Like, I was thinking back to that Eastern Conference Finals when he was on Derrick Rose.
Yeah, mine was 2004 Kevin Garnett at center. And he, of course, was a power forward back then, but his ability to switch, block shots, maybe the best pick and roll defender of all time. That's why I picked him. Then the current Draymond Green at the four, we know what he can do, switchability, protect the rim some. And again, we're not really talking about offense at all here. I mean, it's actually surprising how much ball handling we have on this team and how good some of these players are defensively. And also, you know, these are actually like really good offensive players. But maybe it's possible that either one, guys who are really good on offense get overrated defensively, or just that the athleticism to be an awesome offensive player also really helps you on defense. I tend to go towards the latter. And on this team, guys can really ramp up their effort because we'll have enough offensively. So 2011 LeBron would be my three man. Then I would have Kawhi Leonard guarding the two. Again, a little bit bigger of a guy, but he's guarded point guards before just fine. And also I want the switchability that you talked about. And then I would have Scottie Pippen from 1992 playing the one.
I'm a little bit disturbed by how similar our teams are, but the difference that I had, I actually put Scottie defending threes. You know his background better than I do. Put LeBron on twos. And then partially because of the idea that having a better offense is important, I put MJ, you can pick, you would actually be better at picking the best defensive year, at the one, with the idea that he can be a big part of running the offense and everything like that, and also was good enough at defending, and you're just going to put him on the weakest guy of that group, which is incredible considering how good Jordan was.
Yeah, I mean, this team probably wouldn't have enough shooting if we're talking about offense, but the question was just best defensive five-man unit. And for me, MJ, especially in his earlier years when he had the athleticism, was a little bit too slight to guard guys in the post. And LeBron, I wouldn't want defending twos, because he's the one thing, even in his heyday, that he wasn't amazing at was just chasing shooters around screens. And Kawhi, he guarded Klay Thompson incredibly well, the early Klay Thompson, but he has generally done a pretty good job on him. Kawhi is better at chasing guys around screens if need be, but we could be switching so much with this group, like screens almost wouldn't even matter anyway. And we'd still, with Draymond and KG, LeBron, also Kawhi, Scottie Pippen, like those guys could even protect the rim pretty well and help situations. So I think we'd be pretty good. And then if I wanted to go more to a bygone era, I probably would move KG to the four. because you're going to have post-up fours that you got to deal with. Draymond, I think, could guard most of those old post-up fours, but I could see him maybe getting into foul trouble. And then I think I would go with Hakeem Olajuwon as my center. He, in back-to-back finals, he successfully guarded Patrick Ewing and Shaquille O'Neal, granted an early Shaq. And you would say maybe Bill Russell, but Russell was actually pretty thin, and he played back in an era when you couldn't really be that physical in the post, like fighting for position. So he probably actually wouldn't be as good against like some of those big behemoths from the 80s and 90s.
Hakeem also did a good job from what I remember on switches, and that would be a big part of, even if you're going with a bygone era, just well on pick, not on full switches, but on a pick and roll, just staying with the guy for a couple seconds, and you're going to need to do that even in a bygone era.
Starscape Sonics. Is MKG the only quote-unquote elite defender who gets lit up on a semi-constant basis? He had all these games where he's gotten scored on pretty badly this year. Melo and LeBron had 60 a few years ago. I mean, that was on a bad, against a bad Bobcats team that he, you know, wasn't as good as he is today. But MKG is not unbelievable on the ball. It's really his off-ball stuff helping at the nail, his rebounding, his intensity. He's decent on ball, but he's not the elite athlete and the guy with even, I think, elite length, the way you'll see with a lot of just the absolute unbelievable stoppers like an Andre Iguodala in his heyday, Kawhi, not quite as strong or as has the hands of Kawhi. I mean, that's one of the things that MKG is not. He doesn't really have the ability to get into his guy and make him uncomfortable and get a lot of steals. I think he's a pretty low steal guy. So I think he has a good defensive effect overall, but he to me, the lockdown reputation for him has never quite been deserved.
He's more of a team defender than, like, that's where he's best. And those guys are important, but it's a different thing. So if he has that reputation as a lockdown one-on-one defender, I've never even really thought of him that way, but he's still very good in the team concept. And Clifford, I think, uses him well. Next question is from 0278 Gross G. Has Greg Monroe increased his trade value to where he is actually an asset this year at the trade deadline?
You know, it would help if they just started him. Although they've had some, Henson has had some moments, and I do think that Monroe helps when you've got either Giannis or Jabari out of the game to get a little bit more offense. He has been playing well. I don't really think he's been much different than he was last year. Maybe the perception has just changed because the Bucks themselves aren't disappointing. And even pretty much all of his stats were not as disappointing last year as just the overall Bucks record. And you know, I think that Monroe still is going to struggle defensively. That's always going to be the case. I think that he could have value for a team that is capped out, but only of course if he agrees to opt in for next year, which, you know, I don't know that he necessarily would at this point. I mean, for a team that just doesn't really have anybody at backup center that needs some more offense, I don't know if they would be giving up a first round pick, because he's not like, if your team is already good, he's not really going to help you that much. And if you're not good, then your first round pick is going to be too good to really bother with him. So I would not expect him to be moved. I would put it that way.
I don't think he's moved all the way into the asset category, but he has gotten less negative, maybe even to the point of being neutral for the right team.
Do you agree with me that he's not playing any differently, though, than last year?
He's not being exposed in the same way. So, yeah, that is a fundamental.
Well, Giannis is much better defensively. I think that's helping him.
It is, and they're not playing as much, from what I remember. They're not playing as much of the Giannis, Jabari, Monroe trio, which was also part of the problem. And those guys, the other two, have gotten a little bit better. So there are teams... I've heard some mention of like the Pelicans, like a team that doesn't have much cap space.
Yeah. They would probably trade. But their first rounder is too good.
No, here's what I'm saying. Yeah. They would trade an expiring contract maybe for him. So that would be a risk mitigation prospect for the Bucks, just to, if they didn't want him to opt in, they could trade him and just for expiring contracts.
But allow me to interrupt here, though. If I'm the Bucks, I mean, they're not going to have space even if he leaves at this point. Like, why not just hope that he does opt in? I mean, he's been helping them.
I'm fine with that, too.
You're not going to do any better.
I'm fine with that, too. If they're at that point, and if they're not as impressed with Plumlee and feel like they have to have him in the rotation, like, the reason you would move him in that sort of a way would be to appease him. Because the financial part, you're right, with the Giannis extension, it doesn't really make that big a difference.
Well, New Orleans is where he's always been rumored to go. They could use him... as a, I think, even a starting center, and maybe he would close, maybe he wouldn't, you know, just because, like, Ashik he's been okay on defense this year, but not a starting quality center. Ajinsa is terrible. maybe you could see, and this is just totally off the top of my head here, something along the lines of them trading, like, you know, Solomon Hill for him or something. Or maybe it could be Quincy Pondexter, just on the hope that Pondexter could someday get healthy again for the Bucks, and then and send back like a little bit of matching salary as well. And maybe, you know, a second rounder from the Pels, which will probably be end up being a pretty good pick, something along those lines. But I mean, for the Pels, if he can opt out, there's really no reason for you to trade for him this year, because they're done already this year. And if he can just leave, like, why give up an asset for him?
Yep, that's why I wouldn't.
Mikhail Gorbachev, solid name. Rank these point guards: Kyrie Irving, Damian Lillard, John Wall.
It's tough for the regular season. These guys are, you know, they have different strengths and benefits, but they're relatively close. There are some teams where I like Kyrie a lot better if he doesn't have the same obligations offensively, but you can't do that in the abstract. You have to assume the point guard is going to take on a lot of that role. I would go Lowry 1, Lillard 2, Kyrie 3, John Wall 4, especially if Wall's defense has degraded like it looks like it has early in the season, because that's the benefit he had on at least two of the other three. In the playoffs, Lillard's ability to score one-on-one gets a lot more important. I would move him over Lillard in that context, maybe over Lowry.
I think, yeah, in the regular season, Lowry statistically has been the best player over the past year, last year, and then this year. Was a top 10 player in the league. I had him, I think, as like number 8 last year based on what he was doing in the regular season. That was too high. Lowry has struggled in the playoffs, but during the regular season, I mean, the Cavs have been like 2 or 3 points per 100 possessions worse with Kyrie Irving on the floor versus off. I mean, that's really difficult to reconcile in the regular season. Now, we know what he's been able to do in the playoffs, that ISO scoring is more useful. That upside is more useful when he can just get hot and just can't be stopped. He has the highest factor among any of these. Lowry is by far the best defensive player out of these guys. I would actually rank Kyrie last in the regular season out of all of them. Wall, his defensive decline is troubling, but still, I mean, he's having the best offensive season of his career, and I think can bring it at times on defense still. Lillard, another guy whose defense has just been incredibly troubling, along with Kyrie, and Lillard is ranked as one of the worst point guards in the league by defensive RPM, but probably one of the best offensive point guards. It's really tough when, you know, you have the 30th ranked defense right now, and he's a big part of that problem. I mean, there was even a story that Portland wanted him to kind of talk to everybody about improving their defense, and he knows that his defense is so bad he wasn't even comfortable saying that. I mean, it's good to be self-aware in that way. So if you wanted to just for the regular season, I probably would go with Lowry. In the playoffs, I would probably go with Irving. But I mean, this is a great question. This is very, very difficult. I think any of these, you would have a very plausible argument that they could be the best of these, especially if Wall could get back to where he used to be on defense.
Next question is from Dominic16. It feels like the excuse of losing to a back-to-back is more prominent than ever this year. Do you two have any opinion on if back-to-backs truly contribute to poor play, and do the advanced stats have any say in this?
Well, there's a couple components to this. One is this issue of that on road back-to-backs, research has shown that you're up to 3.5 times more likely to get injured. And now that's still, you still have a pretty low chance of injury. So yeah, it's higher, but 3.5 times of something very low is still relatively low. I think from what I recall seeing, and I haven't gone back to look at this, that playing on the second game of a back-to-back is worth like about, you know, negative 1.5 points per 100 possessions. So this whole and I do understand the trend that Dominic's talking about, that I find a little bit annoying, when it's like every shot that they miss, oh, this team is so tired, like they just can't make this, you know. It's like, I think it's more subtle than that for sure, but you know, you did a little bit more research into this, and I think also like the 4 and 5 nights 5 and 7 nights, those are the ones where teams can look a little bit more tired. But the fact is, I mean, there's just so much confirmation bias here. Every time a team has their shots be short or looks tired, which I don't even know what that is necessarily, looking tired versus not, you know, to measure that objectively, if they just do that at home on a day when they've had a few days of rest, it's just they're being lazy, or they're not playing well, or they're not focused, or whatever. But if they play the same way on the second game of back-to-back, it's ascribed to being tired. And, you know, there just is not that level of precision. I think at this point, this whole, like, I'm watching the game, they're on the second game of back-to-back, that's why they're not playing well, that's going way too far at this point.
A big reason why that happens is also due to the nature of how stuff is announced, because a lot of times when you're watching games, particularly on League Pass, you're watching a feed of an announcer who is an employee of the team, and it's a lot easier to say they're missing shots because of this structural thing than they're missing shots because they're not good or something like that.
That's a
so
great point.
You get that explanation built in, especially when you get those kind of employee announcers.
Yeah, but and people love to make excuses. Like that's just,
sure.
That's
it's just... it's a lot better to say that than a lot of the other alternatives. Like, oh, you're missing shots because of that. But there is some basis also behind it. Baxter Holmes and ESPN have been doing, Haberstroh's been on this for a while, the idea of DNP rest and everything like that. And one of the I went back and reread parts of Baxter's piece from early in the season, because they're doing this kind of checklist alert, schedule alert thing. And so they talk to a sleep consultant who does some stuff actually at UCSF over around where we are. And they built a formula with us. And last year, that formula, based on those big schedule losses, correctly predicted losers about up to 78% with zero consideration for the quality of teams. So I don't know exactly, because I don't have a full context to understand what that number means, but at least it sounds somewhat notable.
Yeah, and I think that formula is more of these, like, you know, four games and five nights type of games. Now, I think just a lot of these accolades, and this is not, you know, Baxter's reporting on this has been great, Haberstroh's reporting on this has been great. It's an issue. I think the season should be, the number of games should be reduced. We talked about that ad nauseum most recently yesterday about the number of games in the season. But there's also a phenomenon in which people who are attempting to provide new knowledge and just move the needle in the conversation can be a little bit more adamant about their system or their position than maybe is really warranted, because you have to even move the needle to the middle, and also frankly to get attention, which is fine, that's like, this work deserves attention, you're gonna go a little bit further in terms of talking about the consequences of this thing than is actually maybe warranted. All right, let's move on here. This one we can take pretty quickly. Kubide Kaczynski, he's basically saying, if you balanced out every roster across the league as much as possible and gave every team optimal coaching, what would the average level of competition on a given night be like? My guess is it would be like having a league full of Western Conference sixth seeds.
That seems reasonably close. I think that if you equalized it for talent, the teams with the best players would really benefit from that, because you could see it with a guy like LeBron. If you're going to say that you equalize it
in the playoffs, especially.
Yes, especially in the playoffs, their ability to draw fouls, their ability to initiate an offense. And
they play more minutes too.
Sure. So that would be the way that I would kind of describe it in terms of seeding. Yeah, something in the those teams would maybe be around like a 5 seed and the other teams would be around like an 8.
Well, and then the injuries, of course, would be huge to determining it. I mean, but I hope the league doesn't turn out that way. I mean, are you really enjoying watching like the Pelicans right now? You know, it's or the Kings, like these teams with like really good players that don't have any help. Like I like seeing great basketball. I mean, the reason that the finals was so good last year is because you had probably 7 of the top 25 players in the NBA playing in it last year, or I guess probably 6 of the top 25 players in the NBA playing in it last year. Another quick one here, Young Guan Yu. I know that both of you don't have the best opinion of this year's Magic or the future Magic, but please give me some hope besides improving defense and the nice Evan Fournier contract.
They have some young talent. I mean, Eric Gordon just had a great game for them. I believe that at power forward, he can be nice for them. I like Bismack Biyombo. I like a lot of the guys on this team. I just don't like how they fit together. So that means that you can move some players and get a better fit, get some more spacing, things like that. Also, I believe they have all their own first round picks moving forward, which is always a nice thing, because in terms of hope, it gets really tough when you start to have those future obligations.
Well, Alex Martins has declared that they will win a championship by the year 2030. So that's all the hope you need.
Yep.
and my of course reaction to that was oh really, is he planning on resigning before then?
Also, that is the strangest way to generate hope of saying, yeah, we're gonna win a title in the next 15 years. that's a ludicrously long time. It's not like we're contenders.
I have a serious answer to this question though. Aaron Gordon had 33 last night. Alfred Payton had 26 and 14 the game before that. They've been put up some really awesome games offensively lately. Frank Vogel is a solid coach. I mean, I think that if they can smooth out some of these structural things on their roster, that it, you know, it's not impossible that if they just get some development, play great defense, Which, sorry, I know that's you noted that, and I was supposed to say something else. Like, and Peyton, it's not impossible that he could develop still. I guess if they don't make the playoffs this year, you could say that maybe there'll be a new regime. But again, I think that the problem there, while I've not been impressed with what Hennigan's been able to do, separating him from the overall structure there, all indications are it wasn't his idea to bring in Skiles and then listen to him to just trade away Tobias Harris for nothing and then have Skiles leave. You know, I think that was more of kind of an Alex Martins thing or an ownership thing. So I wouldn't expect things to get better until there's a shakeup in that area, even if they do bring in a new GM. That's not optimism, I guess. But I guess you could say, hey, if there's a new regime that comes in, maybe they'll demand more power. Who knows? But I mean, it's not hopeless there. I think it's hopeless in terms of like, hey, you've got championship upside with this group, or even like, you know, getting into the second round regularly upside. But the cupboard's not bare there.
It isn't. Next question is from Jesus Sinful Hands. What teams are going to commandeer the Tank Express by March? I'm thinking Dallas and Miami. Anyone else? I have a couple answers for it, and it will depend a lot on context, what teams fall off. Denver could certainly go in that direction. It would likely be fueled by making some moves near or around the deadline. The Pelicans, if they go really far off, just in terms of maximizing their pick, and because for them, that would just basically be resting Anthony Davis. It's not that hard. Whoever falls way off the pace in the East, I don't even... And then there's another group, which is teams like the Suns and the Nets and the Sixers, where I'm not completely sure for them what tanking looks like. I guess it'd be giving a little bit more minutes to their young guys. Right. But yeah, I guess.
Yeah, or like they could shut down Bledsoe. They could just shut down like Brook Lopez the last five games of the season, like the Nets did, even though they don't have their pick, obviously. I mean, I think the Kings, I mean, we saw DeMarcus Cousins rest last night as they just got completely destroyed in Houston. Man, the game that they played in Houston, the last game of the season last year, and then this one, like those might just be like the two worst NBA basketball games that like a team has played in one city over like the past 10 years. Really pretty remarkable how bad that was. But yeah, because Gay was out, so they just decided to they planned to rest Cousins, they claimed. I'm sure that plan arose as soon as Gay got injured. But you know, they certainly have a history of doing that. They have this is the last year of that top 10 protected pick. And the Lakers, you know, they now have lost 8 straight. They're 10-18. They could be starting to think about that Philly pick a little bit. At least they're not going to get up to the top 3 at this point, but they could at least get into 5 or 6 and increase their chances for some lottery luck to keep that one again. And as we know, the stakes there are huge, because if they keep this one this year, then they also don't have to give up a pick to the Magic in 2019. So they certainly have plenty of incentive. Luke Walton's going to be against that. There's this whole timeline thing with Jim Buss. Mitch Kupchak isn't going to want to lose his job. They're going to want to show progress, et cetera, et cetera. But I mean, they could realize that it's pretty hopeless down the end. But again, they have so many young guys, you know, maybe they would rest like Dang or Mozgov or something. But again, yeah, it's one of those ones where it's like, hey, we're playing our young guys anyway. There's not really, you know, what does tanking look like for them? Let's move
on. One more I want to mention is Orlando, potentially. It doesn't make sense with the structural incentives given their current front office. But if ownership gave the directive of basically like, this is over, then maybe they would do something like moving Ibaka if they didn't think they were going to re-sign him or something like that, and they could move to something more like a youth movement eventually.
Yeah, maybe the Wolves will just start playing Chris Dunn, although I think that would just hurt Tom Thibodeau's heart too much to like play someone who's clearly inferior to the starter. But maybe they move Rubio. They could fall into that category as well. This is a quick one that I'll just take. This is from Flea with an extra A. How will the CBA rules allowing two extra roster spots with two-way contracts affect the league? Seems like this will make the D-League more appealing for borderline NBA players, which, yeah, that's probably right. But he makes the point that this actually moves the league further away, the D-League, that is, from being an alternative to college basketball for great prospects. And that's absolutely right. I wouldn't say it moves it further away, but it doesn't get it any closer. And the issue is that $75,000 to $100,000 salaries when you're on a two-way contract, that's only for players who can be in the NBA. And obviously, with the age limit not changing, you're not going to be able to be in the NBA. So you're just going to be making that same crappy D-League salary. And it already didn't really make sense, because why would you go to the D-League when you're not a part of an affiliate? You're not an affiliate player. So that team has no reason to invest in playing you if you're really young and developing you. And that's going to be even more the case now when there are even more affiliate players down there from the NBA that they're going to be focused on. So yeah, I think he's correct that the D-League is moving further other way as an alternative. And, you know, I don't know that really the NBA particularly cares to make it that kind of an alternative either. What's next here?
From Max MCC 11, PJ Tucker has received a lot of attention lately for his D on AD and Carmelo. Do you see him being moved to a contender? And if so, which? My read is that the most important consideration here for the Suns is talking to PJ Tucker and his agent about what he wants. You don't probably move him if he's interested in re-signing, though they certainly could. I think they have enough cap space to make that happen. They could trade him and get him back.
Yeah, I mean, they have nothing at the 3 and 4 right now. Like, they could use some but that, I mean, that said, they are going to want minutes for Bender, they are going to want minutes for Chris, and they still
have TJ Warren when he comes back.
Yeah, so maybe, I guess that's true. I mean, Tucker is clearly better than Chris or Bender right now, but if they're going to want to play those guys and they can get something for him, it would behoove them to trade him. And there's a lot of teams, I think, that could use him.
A lot of teams that could use him. And Cleveland still has that trade exception from originally Brent Haywood, now Anderson Varejao, but they don't have assets. They don't have much, because they have a few young talent guys like Kay Felder, I guess, maybe. I really would be intrigued by him on Toronto. Toronto's one of, they don't have that real perimeter guy unless you're a big believer in Norm Powell. Again, asset question is a little bit limited for them because they've already converted some of those assets into play.
Starting at the four on Toronto and for Siakam instead, you know, it's just tough to come up with a price when he's a rental, and I think he's going to be 31 at the end of this year. So the idea that he, you know, you're going to want to extend him for a big contract, you probably don't want to do that. I think you're viewing him as more of a rental, but I think he'd like to go because actually getting in the play, I don't think he's ever been in the playoffs either as a player. So
I floated the idea actually on the Warriors podcast last night that he would be a fascinating buyout guy, just somebody to leave a bunch of money on the table just for that opportunity. And if the Suns are totally out of it and don't think they're going to re-sign him, it's a chance. And then he could choose from a lot of amazing options and probably get part of the room mid-level or whatever if that's available. He'd be one of the most desirable, if not the most desirable, buyout guy.
Yeah, you could probably, like, Toronto, I think, has their biannual that they could use on him as well. There's definitely a lot of teams. The buyout market's going to be pretty hot for some of these guys. You know, they could, that are going to be able to get, like, you know, $2 million for starting in March. It will be pretty nice for them. Yeah, but I mean, just of teams that could use him, Indiana could really use him as a backup four to kind of play the same way as they play with Thaddeus Young in the starting lineup. The Wizards desperately need a backup four as well. The Grizzlies can use any warm body. They could use some more veteran experience in the front court. The Knicks, same thing. Oklahoma City, he could probably start at the four for them, and he'd be one of the best shooters on the roster, which is awful. The Blazers could use him as a backup four too. I mean, I know they have all these centers that they're masquerading at the four, but they have not really played well in those configurations with guys like Myers Leonard trying to play the four, or Vonleh, like they could use an upgrade there. There definitely are some teams.
He would also be an answer to the question we had a couple of times ago about what Chicago's best five is. If you just threw him in, if you felt comfortable with Jimmy guarding ones, Wade guarding twos, and just put PJ Tucker in there, I think that'd be pretty awesome.
Yeah, I mean, Tucker would be really good as a four, as kind of like a Draymond Green light. He's not a good enough, he's not quick enough really to guard some of the best threes, and certainly not guys who are twos, but he can switch, he's really strong, he's a good rebounder, knows position defense, plays hard, and he can be a threat from the corners, not really above the arc. But if you're playing him at the four, your positional shooting is like okay. At the three, he's a liability. So if you're gonna Solomon Hill him and acquire him and play him at the three, you're gonna be disappointed. If you play him at the four, especially as a backup, I think he could really help some team.
I'm totally fine making that a verb now. WJ Feng, who is the most clutch player in the league? I argue Damian Lillard, but most people like Westbrook.
Well, other than Game 7, which obviously is a huge caveat, but he also was injured during that period. And Steph Curry was unbelievable last year, the shots that he hit. And it's had some good moments in previous years, too. He would be probably the guy that I would most look at. Yeah, I mean, that Game 7 was pretty bad. I mean, Lillard and Westbrook, to me, they kind of fall into this Kobe status where people just like remember every shot that they hit and don't remember any of their failures. I mean, you're going to tell me that Westbrook was like clutch in the Western Conference Finals last
year?
Game
six.
Yeah, I mean, like, and that's, you know, I don't think that KD has really been that great either. I mean, you know, so you'd have to throw LeBron and Kyrie into this discussion for sure. I mean, LeBron, you know, does clutch have to be you're hitting the contested isolation jumper to win the game? Not necessarily. I mean, LeBron's clutch performance in game seven, like just defensively running the team, like playing an awesome series, reaching a level that few players have ever reached in that finals, you've got to throw him in there for sure. I mean, and same thing, he was amazing in game six and seven of the 2013 finals.
You can go back even to earlier in his career, that crazy game against the Pistons and various moments. Sure, he had some clutch failings when he was younger too, but oftentimes he was playing on inferior teams and was trying to carry them all the way against these like better Celtics teams and everything else.
Yeah, I mean, really, the only time you could point to for him not coming through to, you know, that he played below his capabilities would be that 2011 finals against the Mavericks. Even in the 2014 finals, like, he wasn't the problem with the Heat. It was just everyone else, and that Spurs team was so nasty. So, I mean, you probably would have to, I would go with LeBron and Curry at this point, would be the two. And I mean, Kyrie has that one shot. He definitely can create a shot in ISO that's going to be a decent look every time, and you like that, but he really only kind of has one like huge shot on his resume right now. And Lillard, yeah, he had that shot in 2014 over Chandler Parsons to win that series, but you know, he's had a bunch of other times where he hasn't come through. I mean, but and like Steph, I mean, think of like what he did in his first game back from the injury. He had 17 points in overtime, you know, what he did in game seven against Oklahoma City last year, and the fact that the Warriors basically were the best clutch team ever in that 73-9 season, and they won every close game last year in the playoffs that he played in. I mean, maybe you could put game one in against the Thunder into that category last year. And obviously game seven was a massive failure for him. But when you look at his overall resume last year, it was like one of the best clutch seasons in NBA history. I mean, and that shot against Oklahoma City would be like in the regular season would have to be right up there with one. You know, that might be like one of the greatest shots in NBA regular season history.
And the year before, the Warriors didn't have that many, you know, clutch moments in terms of a game seven. They didn't play in a game seven that whole playoffs, but he had some big shots throughout. I mean, I think it's fine to, it's those three in some order. I would probably maybe even go LeBron just because I consider defense as an important factor as well.
Elliot Hoffman, what do you think of Charlotte as a Brook Lopez destination? What sort of trade could you see for him?
Steve Clifford has done an amazing job building quality defenses, high-end defenses without great defensive centers. Brook Lopez is certainly that. The problem there is matching salary and assets. Charlotte has a lot of their money tied up in their best players, and you wouldn't necessarily want to give up their best players for him because you're creating an absence where he is. And part of what makes Charlotte great is their balance. We talked a little bit last night about the disappointment from their bench. And Brooklyn is probably going to want, and they should, want higher quality singular assets than Charlotte can provide.
To me, if you're Brooklyn, there has to be enough of a price for you to bother trading him, especially if he hasn't made the statement that he wants to leave, which it seems like all the reports indicate that he's kind of a creature of habit and he's happy there. I think you need two first-round picks or like a good pick that is less protected that has the potential to be in the top 10. I don't think Charlotte can provide the second of those. Two first-rounders is a lot to give up for Lopez. I would like them okay. I mean, I think that backup center has been an issue for them, but they still believe in Kaminsky. I mean, maybe you could get Kaminsky back if you're the Nets and you believe in him. I don't happen to, as everyone well knows who listens to this podcast by now. I think he could help Charlotte. I think he would be a great pick and roll partner for Kemba Walker. He is a much more versatile player now with his fact that he's shooting threes and spacing the floor. I think he works with a lot more lineups right now than he used to, but he's not going to be good defensively. He's going to not be able to play down the stretch of some games if you're a really good team, just because they're going to space him out. So that's a concern. And I don't think that there is a team really out there that's going to want to give up two first round picks. And so if you're the Nets at that point, you're not tanking. You don't really have anyone behind him that you're trying to develop at this point. So why not just hold on to the guy and at least, like, you know, make things less miserable for your fans over this period? You know, one first round pick in the 20s is not going to make me want to change that. And then you got to match salary too.
He could be an example of a player like Serge Ibaka, where with Serge Ibaka, it made sense for OKC to move him, where just some team makes an offer that you and I wouldn't make that Brooklyn just loves. That's certainly a possibility. Lopez is very talented, and now that he's added the three-pointer, it helps the sales pitch. But there is a bumper crop of quality centers, and a lot of the good teams have one already or don't have an interest in giving up those assets. And Lopez, while as good as he is, and he's one of the, if not the best, offensive center in the league, I can't think of a team that he pushes over the top, and that's really when you would see that sort of thing. And a lot of those teams, like Charlotte or like Toronto, maybe, that could use one more player, he's not the one more player they need.
The list of teams that I thought could actually use him, I think he would be an upgrade for the Blazers with what he's able to do to space the floor a little bit. I mean, he'd provide more rim protection than they have, although he's still very limited in that capacity. He would fit into their system of just playing very conservatively. And, you know, if the Nets still wanted Alan Crabb after a year after that offer sheet got matched, he can actually then be traded to the Nets, and maybe a first rounder that might make sense, especially if they were to move on from Plumlee this offseason, and he just gets some offer in restricted free agency that they don't want to match. I think the Suns actually might be an interesting destination for him. I don't want to give up my own first rounder there if I'm the Suns, but maybe they could maybe give up, you know, one of those Miami picks that they have coming and get him. I probably wouldn't do that if I were them, but I think he would just fit in well with what they're trying to do, like, again, with his ability to space the floor, run some pick and roll. Their centers are you know, they have one of the lower end center rotations in the league right now. I don't know if Alex Len is the answer. They desperately just need some more spacing. Getting that at the center position, he'd be a great fit with Bledsoe, with Booker running pick and rollers, just spacing out to let them work. So that might be an option. The Suns are one of the teams that has the assets to go there at this point.
I'm sure New Orleans
wouldn't do that deal, but maybe it could.
I'm sure New Orleans would love to have him, but they don't really have the assets.
Yeah, and they also need to play Anthony Davis at center for half the game. So. All right, I will take this one because I know that if you take it, you're just going to go on forever about it. Basically, they want to scrap the conference format to ensure a better overall postseason. This is from Kevin Wilson 16. I know you're completely on board with this.
I'm on board with that part of it, not the next part.
Yeah, I mean, he's got some whole long proposal here, but the reason it's not going to work is because for TV in the playoffs, you have to have teams on the West Coast for that second game in the first and second round of the playoffs. Otherwise, they're just not going to have the programming if it worked out that too many East teams and West teams were playing on a given night. Or even the first game, you know, if a bunch of the teams were West teams, you can't have that West team playing at like 4 o'clock for Eastern time zone. So that's the biggest reason. I also am just against it because I love the conference rivalries, and I like the idea of having to go through this team every year. That's what some of the great rivalries in NBA history were built on. Pistons, Celtics, Pistons, Bulls, Sixers, Celtics, those type of things. Spurs, Lakers in the 2000s, where you're like, hey, we need to beat this team, and we're going to like orient all of our moves to try and do that. Like, I love the obsession that engenders within the fan base.
Next question is from C_Hart44. Excluding injury, what player has disappointed you the most relative to your expectations at the time of the draft? I struggled a lot with this because some of the players who were the most disappointing to other people were not as disappointing to me. Anthony Bennett is one of the biggest examples of that. I think I had him 8th on my board at that time. That was an issue. Some of the biggest examples of this will probably be more current players that we just don't know all the way yet. Dante Exum could be there for me eventually. Marcus Smart could be there eventually for me. Andrew Wiggins, depending on how things turn out, because the sky was the limit. Another guy who I had sky-high expectations for and just didn't reach them, he's a very good player, is Ricky Rubio. I thought at the time Ricky Rubio was the second best point guard prospect of that kind of post-2000 era behind Chris Paul. He's been very good, but he hasn't reached anywhere close to that level.
Yeah, most of my guys fall into a theme of that was really kind of built by what the early 2000s were in terms of an era with power forwards, where you had guys like Rasheed Wallace. Tim Duncan was considered a power forward back then. Chris Webber, Kevin Garnett. It was just a golden era for power forwards. That was a premium position in a lot of ways at that time. And so Anthony Bennett was one of those. I don't know if I would have had him as the number one pick, but I thought he would be pretty good. Again, these are times I didn't really start getting into the draft stuff until 2014, when I really would start looking at film of the top 10, because I was a lawyer before that. But the guys who really disappointed me, Tyrus Thomas was a huge one. The statistical translations, the early ones from John Hollinger, really liked him in that 2006 draft. I was happy as a Bulls fan at the time that they traded away the pick that was LaMarcus Aldridge to draft him. That was a disappointment. He just was really athletic, could block some shots, but just never really developed as an offensive player. Terrible finisher around the rim when he wasn't dunking, although he was better than a lot of people remember. And then as soon as he got traded to Charlotte, injuries kind of ruined his career. But, you know, not a very intelligent player. Didn't kind of have it in terms of work ethic, that kind of stuff. So that was one. Anthony Bennett was one for me. Thomas Robinson and Derek Williams, I thought would be, like, not superstars necessarily, but I thought they'd at least be pretty good. But then again, those are, like, scoring skilled power forwards that I felt like that were athletic that just never really developed, and also just were not the most intelligent guys. And a lot of it too is just that, and when I say intelligence, I just mean it on the floor in terms of their game. Of course, the evolution of the game has really been away from those sorts of power forwards as well. And then one that I thought was a pretty good pick at nine was Trey Burke. I really liked what he was able to do in the pick and roll at Michigan, and I thought he would be a solid plus shooter at the point guard position, and just has never really been able to score efficiently. His athletic limitations obviously have been an issue, and the way he's played so far in Washington, he's like on his way out of the league right now.
I should also add in, there were guys that were drafted a little bit lower that I really liked, like Roddy Bobois, who I thought he could work as kind
that's
of a combo.
That's injury related, but... though. He was good.
Yeah, that's true. Hurt. That's true.
I mean, you, I'm sure you were at that 40-point game that he had in Golden State, right?
I
that
believe so.
Been probably your first year covering the team. Yeah,
I think I was there. I liked him a lot.
A couple other ones that I had, Mirotić and McDermott. I just hope that they could be more versatile offensively. And I think part of that is because they haven't really been used in that way. Like, I thought McDermott, someone who could be used more in the post, actually create some offense against smaller players. They've so desperately needed those two guys to just space the floor that actually the Athletic Chicago had an article today about how Mirotić has just been reduced to a floor spacer, and he's the versatile game that we saw from him his rookie year that we just haven't seen it. So those guys could still be pretty good in that way, but they obviously, you know, we haven't seen it on the court. Maybe it's because they're being used, maybe it's just because it can't be used. And then Andres Biedrins is another one who was very good for a time, and then really just the free throw shooting, and, you know, I think some of his off-court proclivities really kind of derailed his career. I mean, he could have been a very solid starting center in the league for a long time.
We could do an interesting list at some point in the future about the disappointments from year one on. So, like, guys who had a really good rookie year or second year and then disappointed after that.
That is a good one. I'm going to write that down. We should do that. Just, like, guys who just disappointed, like, inexplicably kind of just, like, fell off, or you were just, like, so excited for.
Next question, I think you're better to answer this, considering your connection with him. The THEJOA, I think it's a G, might be a Q. You didn't talk much about Jabari Parker's development on your prospects pod. It's clear he needs to get better at drawing fouls to score more efficiently. Do you think he'll be able to increase his free throw attempt rate?
Derrick Rose was able to do this. I actually talked to him about that on that 15 and 60 for about a couple of minutes about his drawing fouls. And he says basically he tries to go hard to the basket and he doesn't engage in kind of the foul seeking behavior that a lot of guys do. I think kind of the problem is that guys just bounce off of him. He goes to the basket plenty. So I think he is going to have to change his mindset a little bit, even if a mentality that I happen to sympathize with. He thinks it's like kind of wussy to just be crying for calls or doing this call seeking behavior. Unfortunately, in the modern NBA, you kind of have to do that to really maximize your success. And he also has got to get better at finishing around the rim. And I think if he gets more foul calls on those plays, that would really help him. But that offense is not my concern for him really at all. It's just really defense. Is he going to be totally one dimensional? Is he going to be a liability, especially on the defensive glass? Is he going to be part of the problem there? Is he going to get traffic coned a lot? Can he play some four defensively? I mean, they've actually had him playing mostly on the perimeter, which he's not really that good at either. That's going to be the issue for me about whether he can really get into being, you know, a top 20, top 15 player in the league, or whether he's just going to be a great scorer and you know, maybe creator and little else.
I think he can get better. It also will help if he gets a better jump shot, just because if people buy it on his pump fakes, then he can get more separation, get to the lane, and sometimes you can get calls that way. But he's already doing a good enough job getting to the interior, so it's not a big problem. Next question is from G1660. James Johnson signed a 1-year, $4 million contract with the Heat this year, has played pretty well. He'll be an unrestricted free agent this offseason. Who do you see targeting him and at what price?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not that excited about him. He's going to be 30. He's gotten into better shape in that because the Heat really do a nice job of cutting people up and really holding guys accountable for their body fat. That was an issue for him these last couple of years in Toronto. You know, I mean, he's always going to just be a bench guy. I think he'll be on these kind of 1 year deals. Maybe he'll get a 2 year deal in the $5 million a year range, but I think he's going to be kind of just a rental guy, not someone that is going to be signed to a contract where you're really relying on him over a period of multiple years to be a solid bench guy.
He's not good enough to be a starter, and somebody who is more defensive minded or that you want that has more upside on that end, you want that guy to play against starters. So you get into a real perilous situation with those type of guys. This could eventually become an issue with Rondae Hollis-Jefferson. I think he's a little bit better, but you're going to do that. One of the big benefits for Johnson is the expanded mid-level exception. It's going to open up some more opportunities for him. Maybe a team that's doesn't have a lot of flexibility just kind of throws some or all of their money there at him. But as you said, giving him a long-term contract this year would be ill-advised. Granted, teams give ill-advised contracts all the time.
Papa Barnes 10, why do NBA teams that like playing small like the Celtics continue to insist on starting one-dimensional centers like Amir Johnson? I think the reason is just because everybody else does it and you have to get some minutes. Like, it is the rare team that A, can force some of their small guys to play. There's a worry of wear and tear, you know, like Draymond Green, for example, playing at center the whole year, even though that's the Warriors' best configuration. And just if you need to get some minutes out of it, if the other team is also starting a traditional big, that's when you have to do it, because if somebody else goes small, now those guys can't play. So I think it's just a question of eating up minutes. It's a question of these guys are kind of highly paid. A lot of them are veterans, are leaders. And so you're able to basically keep some harmony in the locker room, because you can either start guys or close guys, and starting them is probably a bad player is probably easier than closing with him. So I think it'll probably continue forever. It's just, you know, you have to start a center that's just so ingrained in the culture. I don't think that's going to be ending anytime soon.
The Celtics specifically also have really bad defensive rebounding. And so if they were going small against traditionally big units, they would just get massacred on that end even more than they already do. So that's probably part of it as well.
TRNTG, what's the best approach for discussing basketball at greater depth with more casual fans without being condescending?
It's a challenge, always. One of the ways that I like to do this...
condescending, by the way.
Well, no, it's just a challenge in any field to talk about. To talk about an issue where there is a knowledge gap in a way that doesn't offend the other person. I admit to not being great at it many times, and it's something I deal with in other fields as well. I like to focus on commonalities and then maybe give a little bit more context for it. So let's say in the example of the Warriors, maybe you could say like something that helps quantify their ball movement or helps quantify why their defense works. And so if it's somebody who's a Warriors fan, it's trying to give a little bit more context for why what they're seeing is true, and then you're confirming it in a way that helps them think about what the great thing that they already like.
Don't argue with them right off the bat. That's a good start. I think that there are some advanced stats where it's like, oh yeah, the Warriors ball movement is great. Yeah, you know, they lead the league in passes per game, like that kind of thing. Like passes per game is something that anyone can really understand. I think also just talking about awesome plays or awesome teams from the past or like things that just you enjoy on an aesthetic basis is something that works pretty well to me. Don't try to bring up like RPM or PER or something like that. Like, just to keep it to stuff that would be discussed on like a normal NBA broadcast. And I think you're in pretty good shape there. And it depends, you know, there are plenty of what you would call casual fans who watch every game, but just don't necessarily understand some of the advanced stats stuff or that. And I think it's easy to have a conversation with those people when you're just talking about like, oh, Steph Curry is so awesome, you know, those type of people, then it's like, yeah, you know, he is. He's one of the greatest shooters ever, that kind of thing. All right, this is a good one I like. It's from So Damn Frosty. Which of the approximately one-man show Eastern Conference teams of the early 2000s was the best? He's thinking of the Bucks with Ray Allen, although I would dispute the idea of them being a one-man show. But I think it's also kind of just which of those teams that was just viewed as a contender because they're in the East but had no chance against whoever came out of the West in those years could be the best. The Sixers with Allen Iverson, Celtics, Paul Pierce, the Nets with Jason Kidd, who is Mr. Damn Frosty's personal favorite player, the Raptors with Vince Carter, or any other teams he forgot. and I would add Tracy McGrady and the Magic to those.
This is more your era than mine, but the Iverson teams had a lot of success in various ways. Record, they also made that finals that they won one game from the Lakers. My personal favorite, and again, biased like the author of the question, Jason Kidd was my favorite player at that stage of growing up, and those Nets teams were a great display for him. He made a lot of guys a lot of money, and they made a couple of finals and got their butts kicked. They were my favorite of that. I'm not sure they were the best team. The best team was probably the Bucks, but I also don't think the Bucks qualify.
Yeah, I mean, I think we could talk about the Bucks since he mentioned them. Yeah, I mean, they did have Sam Cassell, and they had Glenn Robinson on that 2001 team that lost in seven, hard-fought seven-game series to AI's Sixers. Scott Williams was injured, I think, late in that series. He might have even gotten, like, suspended for a game six or something. I don't remember it that well, but if he had been around, they might have actually beaten the Sixers. They probably, their offense was good enough that they probably, oh, I guess, you know, you could also, even though they weren't a one-man team, you could throw in that 2000 Pacers team as well into that mix. And that team had a fantastic offense. I would say probably those Bucks, just because I think they could have, at least they could score. Like all these other teams, like their offenses were pretty crappy. Like the Nets were a really bad offense during those years. McGrady in 03 was probably the best season that any of those guys had when he averaged 32 a game on really good efficiency. That was the year that they were up 3-1 against the Pistons. And he kind of said like, oh, it's going to be so great to get out of the first round. And then of course they lost the last three of that series and they had nobody. I mean, that was like the Andrew DeClercq starting at center teams. Like the team that could have been there, one was the Magic if Grant Hill hadn't had the injury trouble. And then the other one was the Raptors. If McGrady had actually re-signed there, he and Vince Carter together would have been pretty awesome. But yeah, I think I will go with those Bucks teams just because I think their offense was pretty difficult to stop. And when healthy, they had some injury concerns. I thought that they're pretty good. And you know, things kind of imploded from an emotional standpoint with George Karl there too.
I don't think we have a username for the next question, but it's a very interesting one. Say you can add any center to the Warriors. Who would you choose to add with the caveat that the Hamptons 5 lineup, so Draymond at center, still remains the best lineup? And then we can also do, he said, if you remove the caveat, who then would you choose?
Yeah, this is the kind of question that you like and I don't, because it's just like I enjoy like the old unrealistic like historical questions, but they're just like, oh hey, like wouldn't it be awesome if like, you know, 1967 Wilt was on the Warriors this year, like
oh, see, I thought of it as current centers. I didn't think of it as historical.
Well, no. I know, but it's just like you'll say every once in a while, like, yeah, like Nerlens Noel would be amazing on the Blazers or something like that. Well, actually,
they could get
it,
him.
It wouldn't be possible for them to defer him. Yeah, that was actually a terrible example, so I apologize for that. But I will keep my answer short. You would want someone who can catch some alley-oops and play some awesome defense, so Dwight Howard would probably be my pick. Or on offense, Nikola Jokic, especially if he doesn't have to close the game defensively, would with his passing at the elbows, spacing the floor with his three-point shooting would be pretty fantastic. And posting up on switches too, he would be awesome at that. So Jokic would probably be my pick. I think just from an aesthetic standpoint, I would just really want to see that.
Jokic would be a lot of fun. Porzingis would be fun for almost exactly the same reasons, but again, that's unrealistic, just like all this is. I would love to see what Joel Embiid could be when you just take away all of his usage. That would be a lot of fun. So I'd kind of go in those directions.
Oh, I had a longer answer than you did.
I, as much as you like to think that I enjoy these type of questions, when it's this open-ended, it's like, oh yeah, well, Carl Anthony Towns would be fun or something like that. It's a little bit too much. You're not trying to fit a piece in as much necessarily.
Gotcha. This is a good one from Room Cakes, R-U-M-E. Sorry if I pronounced your completely fictitious name incorrectly. What team could be considered one player away, in quotes, from challenging the Cavs or the Warriors? The example that comes to his mind is the Raptors potentially adding Paul Millsap, which he acknowledges is a difficult deal to swing. I think that's actually one of the more realistic trades that's out there, because the Raptors do have some assets and Millsap can be a free agent. They're also probably willing to pay the luxury tax with his next contract. This is a good one. What comes mind for you?
The peril here is that if we're talking like in this season, which I think is the more fair way of doing it, you have to give up players to get players. The real exception to that the real exception to that would be the Boston Celtics, because the Celtics have so many draft assets that they could give up other prospective things and build from there. So yeah, if the Celtics gave up a bunch of their assets for the best player who a team is willing to trade, Jimmy Butler would be great. I don't think the Bulls are putting him on the market. Gordon Hayward, if the Jazz were willing to do that, somebody like that. And I do think that if you could add somebody of that caliber to the Celtics, they would be competitive. The Raptors with
I disagree, actually. I think, I mean, that's what the one player away is like. To me, that means, all right, now you're going to be favorites in that series against the Cavs.
They said challenging. So to me, challenging doesn't mean favorites. It just means that it's a reasonable
shot. Well, challenging is even like, I'm like, okay, I wouldn't make the other team a significant favorite in the series. I guess we'll put it that way.
That's exactly why I said the Celtics. I think they fit that.
Yeah,
maybe the Jazz.
I guess I'm lower on what they would be if they got Hayward even.
Consolidated some of their players, I don't know exactly how that would work. They could be monstrous.
Yeah, you know, I guess you have to look at, are we talking about one player away of just, I'm going to take any player in the league and put them on this team? Or are we talking about one realistic player? I'm choosing to look at it in the second vein.
I think
this is maybe why we won't necessarily see those type of trades. Among the players who could actually be available, I don't think that there is anyone who's available that you could add to the Celtics or the Raptors, both the teams that have assets that actually could acquire someone who might make a difference. I don't put the Clippers in that category. The Spurs, maybe if they wanted to like move on from Aldridge and kind of balance things out, like what if they traded like LaMarcus Aldridge for Paul Millsap or something?
Compelling one, just a person who could really generate for them.
Yeah, that might be true. Like, what about like a Jrue Holiday? You know, if the Spurs were to acquire him, I still wouldn't make, I mean, but then they have to play the Warriors. So if they had to play the Cavs, then, you know, I think it would be a little bit different. But I mean, who are you going to add that's going to add up to those four guys? And the Warriors are going to be the number one seed too, to where, you know, you'd really think that that's going to be, you know, a toss up type of series. And the Clips, you know, obviously they perpetually are trying to upgrade at the three, but they just, you know, I mean, they could trade their 2021 first round pick. But I don't know. There's not really the type of 3-and-D player out there that I think is going to put them on there. And even if they did, even if they still got that player, I wouldn't favor them against, I mean, the amount of talent on this Warriors team, like it's completely insane. All right, so next one here, Abstract Atlantean. What are some of the best ways to combat an all-switching defense besides the classic back down on the post against a smaller defender? We've seen a few of these here are coming more into vogue. A lot of teams are working on these. The Warriors, ironically, the team that does the most switching, also face the most switching as well. And one of the best ones is when you know a switch is happening, to kind of break off screening for each other and cut to the basket. Portland was doing a lot of this as well. They had some success on it against the Clippers. And a good one is you have a guard set kind of a back screen for another guard out near the elbow. And then as soon as contact is made with the defender, now you have inside position on that guy. And even before contact is made, you cut backdoor immediately and you can get a backdoor for a layup, and nobody's going to be in help position because on the other side, presumably you're doing the same thing. So that's a really good one. One that Utah does a lot of that I really like is you get the perimeter player switched on the big, then he actually gives it up and then gets it right back so he can attack with a live dribble on the move. And usually when the pass away is made, the big will relax a little bit. So that really worked. Gordon Hayward got a bucket on, I want to say, Steven Adams last night by doing that. Another really good one, I think, is if you just get the other team's best rim protector onto one of your best shooters, and now you just space your best shooter way out, even like a couple of steps behind the three-point line. Now you can just, and you have a guy who's pretty good at going one-on-one, now you can go one-on-one and know that there's really just not going to be that much help there. It doesn't even have to be that particular guy having gotten a switch, so much as it's just like, you know, a Kevin Durant or LeBron James, now that you've gotten the switch and DeAndre Jordan is guarding Steph Curry 30 feet from the hoop, now you can just go to work. I like that one a lot. I think in general is just not settling for just, okay, we got the mismatch, now we're going to attack. Jeff Hornacek actually talked about this when I asked him about it last year with the Suns. You just got to go hard right away. If there's a switch, don't say, okay, if you run a pick and roll and there's a switch, all right, you know, now the guy is there, I'm just going to back it out and go. Like, just go. Go hard. Like, the guy's not going to quite be ready yet. And just, I think generally, the biggest thing too is when you have the mismatches, if you're a guard, just penetrate. You know, if you have a center on you, just penetrate. Like, if you have a center on you, you may not be able to get the shot up, but you at least can get into the lane, and now guys can cut off you. You've got guys who aren't used to guarding their positions, trying to guard other people. You can get people to help. I mean, that's the beauty of it is you don't necessarily have to score, but you can create chaos and then get when your team is an open shot. That's what always kills me about Kyrie against the switch. He can get a wide open shot at any time. Well, I shouldn't say wide open, but an open, long two anytime, but he doesn't attack enough. He never drives to pass. And I think that driving to pass is another thing that you can really do. So that was a long-winded answer. And there are certainly plenty of plays that you can run. Kerr had a lot of great ATOs where, you know, they would set the screen and then cut immediately behind the guy who just switched onto him, that kind of stuff. There are a lot of great options that you can use. And it's certainly a field that's evolving. And especially with set plays, you can really take advantage of switching defenses. And then, of course, there's the offensive glass as well. That's another one, too. Ryan Anderson had a ton of success against the Warriors doing that in that double overtime win.
Anthony Davis did a nice job in the game on Tuesday attacking right away, just immediate attacking. That isn't always back to the basket, but just going at it when you have the mismatch that second. And also, we saw the Clippers to great effect against the Blazers force the bad matchup right away and then just go after it immediately. They would switch, make sure that they got Dame Lillard on Chris Paul, and Chris Paul would just ruin him.
Getting the switch early is another one, too, in transition. If you know they're switching, just set a screen with 20 on the shot clock. Like, the longer they have to defend once they are switched, the harder it becomes. I think when you're looking at guys who are going to post up right under the basket, you know, don't just say, all right, we're going to throw it to you 30 feet from the basket and now you're going to back down. Like, try to really get position. And then also another thing too that you'll see is guys will try to front in the post once there's a switch. And if you can't get it into them, if you're the guy who would be throwing the entry pass, you can do what's called driving the front, where if you can blow by your guy, then there's not going to be any help because the guy is fronting the post, so he can't get around in a help position. You can get a lot of nice drives that way, force some help from the weak side, and now you've got him in rotation again also. So there are a lot of things that you can do, but it takes a lot more discipline and a lot more pace to really attack there.
One from Beep_Meep. Which teams are prime candidates to give up at least one first round pick in order to make a win now move before the trade deadline? The neon sign team for me is the Washington Wizards. They have a GM that is on the hot seat. They are kind of on the fringe where I could see them doing it. They already also did last year. Other possibilities, depending on how things shake out, I would say the Pelicans, the Magic, and maybe the Pistons, just because they don't have much payroll flexibility.
People were kind of joking on Grunfeld because his bio was like really out of date on the Wizards website, and so it like trumpeted drafting like Jan Vesely and Chris Singleton. And I agree, he hasn't been that great. But it was pointed out that in his 13-year tenure, which is an crazy long time, they actually have made the playoffs 7 out of those 13 years. So they've had a lot of talent. I think they've squandered things in some ways. But they have actually been in the playoffs a fair amount. And when you consider the history of the Wizard Bullets before that, for like the 20 years before that, that's actually like not that miserable of a record. All right, last one here.
Sure, where do you want to go?
I like this one. What team from the past can you plug into today's NBA and have more success than they did in their own era? That excludes the all-time great teams. They said we'll arbitrarily set the limit at 2003. I'm sorry, when I pasted in, I forgot the user's name there. I mean, it would need to be a team that was a great shooting team. I think that the 95 Rockets comes to mind, although they did win a championship. I mean, it's really tough because teams played differently back then. And they might have been a team that if you had the exact same league as you did then under the current rules would do better, but then having to play against modern players, especially because modern players are better than their old counterparts, especially when you look back in like the 90s, which was a very diluted league due to recent expansion, and it was before the foreign influx. There's not that many of those teams. The 01 Bucks teams comes to mind. The 93 Suns, I think, would be pretty nasty with KJ going off the dribble. Barkley, nobody would really be able to handle him. They had a lot of three-point shooting. And maybe some of those 80s Bucks teams with Paul Pressey at point forward, Sidney Moncrief. I think Terry Cummings would be someone who'd be pretty difficult to stop. Those are the ones that came to mind for me. Any that you can think of at all?
I like the 95 Rockets. That was one that I had thought of as well, just because they had guys that were shooters. Some of them were a little bit on the younger side, but they could do that. This is definitely more your field than mine. I also was thinking about specific players like Maravich, I think would benefit to a degree from this, and with the hand checking and everything else. But I was thinking more in terms of that, just because I don't know those old teams nearly as well as you do.
All right, last one here. Warriors-centric question. Good one to end on for noted Warriors homer Danny LaRue. What do you think is prompting Steph Curry's pull-up three-point accuracy to drop so much this year? He's only around 30% this year. He was 41-43 the last two seasons. That's what really distinguished him from less skilled shooters.
His frequency has also gone down, which I think is significant, and that goes to the idea of kind of confidence, and that he's not feeling it in the the same way because Curry understands things in the flow of the game. And so he thinks that. But also, those are worse shots when you have Kevin Durant than when you have Harrison Barnes. So it ties in with that. But physically, I think it's at least partially physically that if it's comfort or if it's anything lingering, he just doesn't feel the same comfortability doing those shots as he did before.
A few other things I would note, I agree with all that. I don't know about physically, but certainly a reasonable explanation, just not even being able to work out as much as he would have wanted to during the summer due to that knee injury from last year. I think just maybe regression in the mean, although he was always a good off the dribble 3-point shooter before this. He took 6.2 of those last year. He's down to, I think, like the mid fours right now, like 4.7 or something. I think that just part of it is just a mindset and the guilt, as you notice, because they're so good offensively that like he doesn't want to take what might be kind of a bad shot. I think he's bringing the ball up even less now than he was. So he's just not getting a chance in transition or just to get into a pick and roll really quickly off the dribble. I think also because he kind of feels that guilt about taking that early in the shot clock a lot of times, that when he is taking them, it's kind of because it's the late clock and he's forced to. So they're actually perversely, although he's taking less, there actually are tougher looks because he's only going to those as a last resort. But I don't know, we should ask him about that. I think it's an interesting question, and maybe there'll be more of an answer for that. All right, I think we're done here. I know you got to go, Danny. So thanks for sticking with us on another mailbag. Don't forget about ZipRecruiter.com/capspace, where you can post jobs for free using that capspace URL. And we will be back with a 15 and 60 on Sunday. Actually, I'm going to take a short vacation, so that'll be in two parts, but it's the Western Conference, so you're going to want to listen to the whole thing anyway. We'll talk to you all then.